Trying to fine-tune any system that involves biology and Mother Nature is going to take time, especially when all of those changes need to happen while running a business. Ed Lammers has spent over 30 years implementing new practices and business models on his farm.
Be open to innovation and technology. You know, look at the return, but look at the long-term effects. But with the same emphasis of trying to get better with less, right? Trying to help improve my soil health in any way I can. So being open to changes are crucial, but the economics to allow you to be open up to those experimental challenges or changes are crucial also.
Nebraska farmer Ed Lammers joins the show to talk about cover crops, incorporating livestock, and embracing technology to build healthier soils. This is the Soil Sense podcast, where we believe that building healthier soils is not just a prescription, but rather a pursuit. On this show, we unpack the ways farmers collaborate to build healthier soils and adapt systems to work on their farm for both sustainability and profitability. Let's get to the root of all that and cover some ground on today's episode of Soil Sense. Hey there, thanks for tuning in to Soil Sense. I'm one of your hosts, Tim Hammerich. Joining me, of course, is our co-host, Dr. Abby Wick, and we're sitting down today with Nebraska farmer Ed Lammers. Ed farms in Hardington, Nebraska, which is in the far northeast corner of the state. He's the fifth generation of his family to farm in the area, and the sixth generation, his son, is involved as well. Ed has been farming for about 35 years now and has tried a lot of different practices over that time. In addition to row crops, he and his son also raise about 200 cow-calf pairs and market that beef farm to table. He says that business has really grown since his son took it over, and they're now able to sell around 40% of their beef through that direct-to-consumer channel. In today's episode, we're going to talk about cover crops, incorporating livestock into the operation, technology, and Ed's desire to start raising some rye for seed, which is where we'll start today's conversation with Ed Lammers.
I raise soy, corn, alfalfa, and rye, and trying to decide into a transition of raising rye for seed cells. And the reason I'm contemplating that is I have some acres that are more highly erodible or more have a grade to it to where it would benefit that soil to raise that. But the issue is becoming economic where that's a farm that I rent, so there's a certain amount of income that has to be made to achieve the goals and the inputs that are driving the economic value. You know, some of my practices have changed over the 35 years that I've been involved, and some of those changes are, you know, going no-till, of course, narrow rows on corn and soybeans. I'm on 15-inch row of corn. You know, multiple applications of crop nutrients, soil samples, tissue samples. You know, the importance of that soil health has been more recognizable or more of an emphasis for me. The last 30 years is because the more I got involved, the more I recognized the importance of it. And then also when my sons get older and the possibilities there, you know, longevity of the soil health is, you know, it's got to be one of the top two or three priorities for farmers because long-term wise, we need to take care of it. We don't have soil, we ain't going to have crops. I mean, we could have all the genetics and the seeds and all the preventive packages, all that. But if we don't have the right soil, micronutrients, microbiology going on in our soils, it's going to be an uphill battle.
I'm curious about what got you into these practices 30 years ago. I mean, that's on the early adopter kind of range of soil health. And what was it that got you into them?
Well, just seeing some of the practice, being out there, being a witness, right? And certain conditions of weather storms coming through, whether it's wind or rain, and seeing the impact, right? We may see soil movement collected in a lower area to where, you know, that's not good. Long-term, just the witnessing of the environment, what happens on our soil health, just the recognition of the importance. I think prior to that, I was just you know, more of an actor, right? My father was kind of the principal organizer or manager, and wasn't probably paying too much attention to that earlier. And then also technology, you know, and reading informational stuff, you know, that's always ongoing. And to be open to it and read about it and witnessing, you know, it's hard not to adapt something like that, not to recognize it, right?
The narrow row spacing, what led you to go 15 inches on your row spacing?
A couple things, actually. So about 60% roughly varies from year to year. 60% of my acres are dry land. So we're constantly looking for better production, right? I went to 15-inch beans first. And seeing that, you know, I get a better canopy, earlier canopies, which protects, shades the ground more, but also helps on the weed pressures. So that was the main push. And then just doing some more reading and the hybrids, you know, sunlight is so crucial. You know, in reproductive stage of row crops, it's irreplaceable. So, you know, we went to 30-inch rows first, and 30-inch rows works great for irrigation. I just saw that plant being more distributed evenly gives you a more upside potential. And not only in great weather conditions, but on drier conditions too. I've seen a yield bump. Now, is it consistently a yield bump? You know, in great years, I think it's par or maybe a little better, but the weed suppression is much better. And another thing I want to point out, when I went to 15-inch corn, I've cut down an application of a weed chemical or because of my canopy. Now, with that being said, we've had a couple droughty springs where I'm not getting as fast as canopy, and that has posted challenges. And so I've been doing this for about 5 years now in the corn, and I'm recognizing that I need to pay attention to that. Not really so much inside the field, but on the perimeter of the field, where we have more pressures from, you know, the fence line inward. So as is farming always, you're always learning as you go. So anyway, I recognize that. And I'll keep recognizing a few other things too as I go.
Oh, so I imagine with the tight row spacing, all those wonderful benefits of it, you probably haven't had great success with like interseeding cover crops and that. And is that something that you feel you miss out on, or you feel like you don't?
That does pose a challenge, especially on the higher populations. You know, that's, you know, and I don't want to till it. So it does have a challenge there. But I don't say that's probably my limiting challenge. My limiting challenge is actually timing. In my operation, it starts out as chop and silage. You know, when harvest time does come, chop and silage, and then we follow this chopping machine around the country or the countryside in our area. So that's about a month-long process when he starts, when he gets finished. So that's one operator out of our team. So go back to our practice, silage chopping, and then we go into high moisture corn. And then we go into soybean harvest and then into dry corn harvest. So, yes, on the silage chopping, there's a window there. We'll always get cover crops in. More in my irrigated corn to where it's closer to the farm place, less transportation. One operator gone. It's just labor. It just makes it easier for me to accomplish that. Now, that doesn't say that I won't go to a field that has a disease problem or, for instance, a hail damage problem where the stocks may be susceptible to deterioration, and I need to go out and get that corn harvested earlier just to make sure I get as much as I can. So there's always those recognition of chances where you need to go do it for the right reasons and all that. Anyway, so back to my cover crop. Most generally, getting the silage corn in, I always get that in with cover crops, just for the erosion issues. You have to get the good kind of weather to help that basically plant break down a little bit to get cover crops in there. You have to go at an angle, and the weather's got to be right. I mean, it's got to be dry. The humidity's got to be low. There's just a lot of things you guys got to pay attention to be able to get. Because back on irrigation, I'm at 32,000 population at 15 inch. That seed area is only about that wide that I really get seed soil contact good. So paying attention to a lot of conditions like every farmer has to is crucial. Going into soybean acres, I haven't done much of that just because of the timing. I'm hoping to get there. It backs up into that later half of October where, it will emerge. It will come up in the right conditions, especially under irrigated, it will, because there is moisture there. And then the timing of what kind of growth, what kind of spring you have. There is definitely benefits there. I'm a firm believer of that. It's just I don't have a drill right now. I've been hiring that done, but I am seriously in the market of looking for one. So couple steps I need to follow through on, and I will get there.
Yeah, so you talked a little bit about where you fit cover crops in your rotation. And what cover crops are you using after you chop corn or harvest the wet corn? What are you putting in there?
Mostly rye, and then I put a few turnips in there. So for compaction, depending on the harvest time, if I feel like the soils are wet, that might complicate the compaction part. I put turnips in. Otherwise, it's just been radishes, turnips, and rye. Most generally rye, but there was like 3 years that I did put the radishes and turnips in. Another thing too with that, and especially on the silage corn that we harvest, that rye and the turnips and the radishes are additional feed source to my cows during the fall and spring months. Normally, I get them out of there before spring comes along. But one year, I have a video of it on one of my phones. It was a pretty wet year. I was having pressure on my yard, so I turned out the pears out on this rye and turnips, and they bloomed off of it. And the health of the animal was so much better. They grew, they did real well. And I took a video while I was out there planting beans in it. My cattle were still out in the field. They were kind of running around me when I was planting the beans. So yeah, very interesting. If I would have told that to my father before he passed, he would have said, "You are crazy."
Hey, you talked earlier about the rye. I want to make sure I understand correct. So have you been growing it as a cover crop and now you're looking to grow it for seed? And maybe just kind of frame up that situation for us and how it's done as a cover crop, if that's accurate.
So, yes, that is accurate. And I am trying to move in that direction on the acreage I had. I haven't been convinced that under irrigation is the correct place to be putting it yet. So I'm looking at in the dry land acres. And most of those dry land acres I rent. So the economics of it has not quite been there yet. Now, I'm not saying it's not going to get there, but I'm also looking at it as what's best for that soil. So, for instance, this spring on some of them hills, we had a very hard rain on May 12th, where we had about an inch and a half to 2 inches of rain in a matter of 15, 20 minutes. And that was 10 days or wasn't quite 2 weeks after I had planted it. And that was in no-till soybean stubble. The amount of wash off we had on that property, I don't know if I've seen it in 30 years. So all that kind of information needs to come together and make a good decision for what's best sustainably, economically, and environmentally. I wish it was as easy as saying, yeah, I want to be soil health conscious 100% of my time. But there's other factors that I don't know if everybody recognizes or is talked about enough. But, those are decisions that every producer has to make. And just the programs that are coming forward at least puts a highlight on the possibilities and gives the producer some information about the possibilities that he might be able to do. So that in itself is a great step. In any information we can provide for that data is a step in the right direction long term. 30 years ago, sure, it was talked about, but it was pretty much at an infant stage, right? We came from mobile plows to minimum till to no-till, and that's all kind of evolved over in the last 50 to 30 years, 20 years, 10 years. I mean, regionally, maybe earlier than other regions. So yeah, I believe there's a real importance of sharing that data, not only with producers, but the public. The public needs to understand what all variable inputs or information that a producer needs to have to make good decisions.
Do you find, you know, mentioning the sharing of information with the public, do you find that your son's business of selling the beef, you know, farm to table, do you see that as an opportunity to share some of that message, or are people curious and asking you about it?
You know, that's a great point, Abby. I never really thought about that as a opportunity. Right now, he's just been focused on the techniques of what we do to raise our beef, and, you know, whether it's grass fed up to a certain point in time, and then how we crack our corn and use high moisture and all our own feed ingredients. The only thing we buy off the farm is the distillers, the wet distillers that come from the local ethanol plant. And a lot of that is just basically from bunk management. It makes bunk management a piece of cake, really, compared to what it used to be. And the protein, it's another protein source with some energy. I mean, there's other benefits, but I've been feeding cattle for those 35 or, well, I'm 60, so 50 years. And, you know, just recognize all the changes and the good changes that come along the way. And that's one of them. So, yeah, Abby, to your point, that's another bullet point we probably need to touch on a little bit more, that to his customers or in his advertising, you know, in general. So
I'm curious, do you consider the cattle part of your soil health program? I mean, are they integrated in some way that actually helps with your soil?
Oh, definitely. Yes, the animal nutrients all go back into our soils. Yeah, it's a big part of our input costs and just being a good, sustainable farmer.
One question I did want to ask you, Ed, is, you know, as you think back over the past 35 years or so, how is it different today as a result of all these efforts than it was then? And kind of where have you seen the outputs of your efforts?
Wow. Yeah. So I know the nutrients has gotten a lot better. I mean, with soil sampling and grid sampling and all that. And then also, I understand the water holding capacity of my soils. I did do that measurement. Forget what they called that. So I did a soil measurement of soil water holding capacity. And my pivot, I can set up pie-shaped charts of where the pivot can speed up, or it speeds up in certain soil holding capacities. And then it gets to those sandier little spots that, you know, it's just not only those spots, but it spreads out a little bit, not a lot, but then it slows down there because it recognizes that soil don't hold as the water as long. That was a change for me to understand the importance of that water holding capacity, our soil nutrients, and then, just paying attention to residue, paying attention to that. I see those as a challenge. I recognize, as the years go on, how to break that residue down. What's the cycle of that? When I go a 2-year corn on corn on irrigated, there's an issue there. And on 15-inch rows, my precision of planting in between rows is a must. And so that's an importance I've learned. So the breaking down the residue. Now, sure, that is a challenge, but also with my soybeans, I have a white mold issue in a certain location, and going corn to soybeans doesn't allow enough time to break that pathogen down. It, not that you ever break it down, but it's less. If I go corn on corn on that area, I don't see the white mold issue hardly at all. But if I go corn soybean, I will see a more of a higher percentage of chance. So continually gathering data and making changes, right?
Well, Ed, I mean, when it comes to like the soil health principles we talk about, you know, you've reduced your tillage, you're incorporating cover crops, you've got the livestock. Well, what's next for you? What's next on your mind? What problems are you still wrestling with? What questions are you trying to answer for your operation going forward?
You know, we look at technology, the innovation, the area, the cost of that. What I see probably the most concerning, or where I would like to see a direction go, and you know, I've been involved with the commodity organizations for 15 years or better now, and for 15 years I can always remember saying, well, we need a new chemical, we need a new herbicide, blah blah blah, go on and on. And today it's still the same. The cover crops really can help on that, and at some point in time there's the real value in that for that suppression of some of these resistant weeds. But what I look into is more of the innovation. You know, we have technology that go out and identify a weed compared to the plant, and booms come on for a certain period of time and shut off the other. You know, sprayers have two booms on them, one for overall coverage and then one for a specific weed. That technology, taking another step forward where we get AI coming into a picture, and is there a real possibility we might all become conventional producers again? I mean, those little machines can run around 24 hours. The expense is going to be there initially, like all technology is, but who knows, right? I mean, the capabilities are wide open. And to my point is, I'm not so convinced that we need a new chemical. We've been saying that for years and years and years. You just don't come up with it. Now, I do understand there is a new one coming out. But, you know, as far as I'm paid attention to, nature has always adjusted. And whether we get a new chemical or not, it will adjust again. So that's not a long-term solution. So we'll see where it all goes. I'm hopeful of that. I don't know if that answered your question or not. But I think anything we can do to provide that long term, you know, I'm talking a century from now, the benefits of that, we have to recognize that. We have to strive for that. And whatever it is it chemically, is it micronutrients, is it microbiology? You know, that's another thing I've done in the last couple of years, is I put in biologicals on my seed. My planter, I don't put liquid down, so there was a new technology to come out that put the microbes on the seed, and I put it on the seed as I plant. So I've seen, last year I did a side-by-side, saw a 6-bushel yield bump on my irrigated corn. I only had enough to do on my irrigated. I put it on corn rotation, which I thought the nitrogen needs would be the most greatest there. And I used 10 gallons less of 32%. So again, like all farmers are kind of a scientist, that was a 1-year trial. So we'll see what happens this year. But with the same emphasis of trying to get better with less, right? Trying to help improve my soil health in any way I can. So being open to changes are crucial, but the economics to allow you to be open up to those experimental challenges or changes are crucial also.
Well put. Yeah. And one question we always ask everybody on the show is, you know, thinking about the audience here that's listening, of other farmers around the country that are at varying points in their soil health journey, you know, what if you could boil it down to one message to them, you know, sort of your TED talk to the soil health group here, what would your message be?
Always be open to innovation, but always have the long-term perspective. Always think that your son or your grandchildren are going to come and farm, and what you do today affects them.
The long-term perspective. What a great place to end today's episode. Thank you so much again to Ed Lammers for being on the show. Enjoy getting to spend some time talking to him and hearing about his continued passion for improving that operation. Before we close, I'd like to thank the Soy Checkoff for sponsoring this Farmers for Soil Health series of the Soil Sense podcast. This show is produced by Dr. Abby Wick, Dr. Olivia Cayuette, and myself, with support from the United Soybean Board, the University of Missouri Center for Regenerative Agriculture, and the Soil Health Institute. If you're all interested in what soil health looks like in practice and on the farm, I highly suggest you subscribe to and follow this show on your favorite podcast app, and leave us a rating and review while you're there. Also, be sure to check out the Farmers for Soil Health website at farmersforsoilhealth.com. Until next time, stay curious, keep collaborating, and don't forget to take a minute to stop and smell the soil. Have a good one.